group summer school, Friday morning, 3rd June 1983. We were in absolute union, in timeless conjugation, in the infinite eternal. As indeed, in actuality, we still are, but have forgotten. And then, with a stir in transcendence, which is primordial creative energy, which is absolute consciousness, pure mind, and which is non-material fundamental substance, there arose movement and activity which brought into being the entire cosmos, and separation started there. That unitary whole became the multitudinous many. All existence, all that which stands out of the source from which we come and to which we go. As Eliot has put it, the beginning and the end are one. And as this process proceeded through eons and eons of time and space, we ultimately on this planet came into existence as human, potentially human beings. The organism evolved out of matter to start with. But the creative force, the creative power which underlay it all, sustains it and nurtures it, that creative force is constantly at work. In transcendence, there is only immediacy. There is no past, present, future, beginning, ending, birth, death, and so forth. There is only eternal life, something which one's brain cannot conceive of at all, or form any pictures. It is the formless, it is the shapeless, it is the absolute, but it is that out of which proceeds all this, immeasurable, countless. And when we came upon the scene a few million years ago, we gradually began to develop consciousness in our sense of the term. That absolute consciousness which characterizes transcendence is something which is absolute knowledge, absolute mind, which perpetually forms and brings into being and knows with a knowing that is completely unimaginable by us. So, as we developed consciousness, we began to separate things. This object, that object, this animal, that tree, this man, that woman, and so on, and so on. And thus, separation came into being. And the human species, like every species, procreates true to type. That is why that primordial transcendent creative activity is not expressed by us. We use the word creativeness for ourselves when we produce poetry, art, science, philosophy, and so on. But that is a mistake. We only reproduce that which is true to type. Pure creation is absolute. It has no ancestor, it has no descendant at all. It is absolute, and it is so absolute that time, the time consciousness, utterly fails to grasp such a thing. Immediacy is present all the time. And it goes on, as we who are time conscious would say, perpetually. But perpetuity doesn't apply to that transcendent source. I say these things because only in so far as in our inner consciousness we can begin to thrill to such things that we are on the way, so to say, to our ending, which was our beginning, actually. And we might ask, why then should all this happen? Because all this that happens in existence is full of suffering as well as pleasure. And the pleasure ultimately ends and produces anxiety, produces disappointment, and so on. The bliss that characterizes the Supreme is something which is utterly still. As Eliot put it, the stillness between two waves. And as Krishnamurti has put it, the stillness between two thoughts. But perhaps when he said thoughts, he may have really meant between two distinct attentivenesses. And in the midst, there is that absolute void, of which transcendent consciousness is perpetually conscious. But we get just that single glimpse of that void in the stillness between two attentivenesses, as such. Now, our ordinary consciousness, which is specifically concerned with our difficulties, our problems, our illnesses, our sorrows and our pains and so on, is a discriminative consciousness, a separating consciousness. And it is this which is our sin, so to say. You know how the Catholics say, man is born in sin. Meaning that man is born not through the ordinary procreative activity of male and female, but he's born with this consciousness of separation. It's that which divides, splits up, or tries to split up, or to hurt that absolute unitary wholeness which is the ultimate. So now, in that, now I have to use the terminology of time. In that beginning, there was absolute union and a state of complete bliss, a bliss which, as in terms of our brain functioning, we can only call an unknown, unknowing knowing. That's what it is. Now, to that unknowing, knowing state, we ultimately return. How do we return to it? That original state is the absolute, transcendent love. The love which pushed itself out of itself into existence in order to suffer. And through that suffering, which acts like the perfect mirror to see the reality itself and to be able to discriminate between the reality which is the absolute is from the reality which appears real, the image, the reflection. You see, reflections are as much reflections, dreams, shadows. They are all as much reality in our worldly sense as anything that we can experience through our touch, solidity, liquidity, mass, substance, and so on. They are all real because they are, just as any solid or liquid is a phenomenon, so too a shadow is a phenomenon. A dream is a phenomenon. And insofar as it all belongs to the phenomenal realm, therefore it is, from our worldly point of view, it is reality. It is true. It is there. Now, there is something very important in this connection. If we can see that it is all one great total reality in the limited manifested sense, if we can see that, then there awakes in us a reflection of that transcendent love which first operated to bring existence into being. And then we neither accept nor reject anything and everything. But we see that anything and everything in its procedure from birth to death, from its beginning to its ending, is all part of the wonderful process. This process which is like a cinema show of the transcendent absolute real. That transcendent absolute real completely permeates all that is in existence. And that is the power really underlying everything, which ultimately enables everything to come to its own natural and spontaneous fruition. And particularly so, as far as this planet is concerned, it is with us like that. So that love is the great creative power that once again releases our consciousness into a unitary wholeness. And insofar as that love operates in our particular sphere, it means first and foremost extraordinary compassion, suffering with the sufferer. But this sounds as if it were all very pessimistic. But the fact of suffering and sorrow simply cannot be discarded. We cannot shut our eyes to it. There is also its complementary aspect, enjoying with he who enjoys. What is the process of our education through existence? To learn to enjoy in the right way, not in the wrong way. We are gifted with, now I'm talking of the organism, the physical, the psychophysical organism. We are gifted with our senses. And you have heard me say time and again, our senses are truly the cords of communion with transcendence. Why and how? Ordinarily, when our senses are in operation, what comes to us through our senses is always confined and related to us. The I am. I am I. I am John Brown, or whoever it is. And as we grow up from birth onwards, we are so unwisely brought up and so uneducated by circumstance and that which surrounds us, that we try to spend our life in drawing the universe unto us. We want this, we want the other, we want pleasure, forgetting that pleasure is always invariably accompanied or is succeeded by pain. When pleasure ceases, there is disappointment. There is pain, you see. So we try to live our life in terms of pleasure for the self. And it is that pleasure for the self. It is not pleasure in itself which is wrong, but pleasure for the self, and always wanting to draw from the from what we call the external world to ourselves, is the root of all the, not only the pain that we suffer when the pleasure ends, but also the conflicts that arise when our desires clash with our neighbor's desires, or with other members of our family, or with the way in which members of the family or our friends behave towards us. But then we forget that we too are behaving towards them in mistaken ways, and these two mistakes clash together and produce a pretty little mess. Sometimes it's a pretty big mess. And so there we are. Now, that is the wrong way to use our senses. But if we are capable of being quiet inside ourselves and still, then whatsoever comes to us is absorbed by the psyche. It is absorbed in the right way because it is digested in that quietness. And we are able to grow in insight and in our consciousness of the reality of things through that process of digestion. There is neither acceptance nor rejection. That which is harmful becomes converted into that which is helpful by this stillness, this quietness. You see, it's a little bit like this. You see a shape in a cloud. Let us say you see a face. Can you take a bow and an arrow or draw your sword and have a fight with that face? You can't. Just be still. And the thing changes of its own accord and in its own sweet way. And in our stillness brings about health, fullness, perfection of action in the other. Of course, it's easy enough for me to say these things, but they're extremely difficult to do. And this is where being wide awake comes in very much. Be wide awake all the time, mindful in the real sense. If we are mindful in the wrong sense, then what happens is that we go through eat, drink and be merry type of life and say that it is all right. We might even stoop to murder and lechery and arson and all the terrible things of life and say, oh, I'm doing it mindfully, so it's all right. Well, take an old man's advice. Don't try it. It's not worth the candle. Now, the right use of the senses then implies this inward peace and stillness. And with that inward peace and stillness, what grows is consciousness within us, which is discriminative and separative, which is the force which tries to draw everything to us possessively, changes into a consciousness of the true unitary wholeness with everyone and with everything. When that kind of consciousness has really come into being and is powerfully active, then you will find that your circumstance will change in the most extraordinary way. To be conscious of something is quite different from having a thought, an idea of that thing. It is different like this. If we are truly conscious of love, not of an outflow of emotion, affectionate emotion towards another, not merely that, but if we are truly conscious of love, then our every thought and feeling, our every word and action will inevitably, invariably, naturally, spontaneously express that love. And you will find that that is the love which heals. When our human relationships begin to go wrong, what do we try to do? Haven't you noticed our first reaction is, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong. It's he or she who is doing this, that and the other. It may be the fact that in any particular situation, A has done no wrong, obviously, you see, and B has been a source of trouble. But A being A, in contact with B, somehow evokes out of B something wrong. It's a most extraordinary thing. I've seen this in my own life, I've seen it in my young days particularly, and I've seen it in so many human relationships. And everybody says, oh, poor A, well, he hasn't done, or she hasn't done anything, or that awful fellow B, he's the source of it. Now, yes, but you know how it is. We express it sometimes in ordinary life by saying, oh, I can't stand the sight of him. Why? Why can't I stand the sight of him? He is, after all, another version of me, and I am another version of him. You see? I'll give you an actual example from my own life. During the war, the last war, Hitler was the object of execration. A terrible fellow, Hitler, you see. And those were the days when I was living in Cardiff. Sylvia and I were in her father's house. And there was a little woodland at the back. And we had an extraordinary winter when, I'll tell you, yes, 1940 it was. The whole country froze, you remember? And the branches of great oak trees and so on had quantities of ice formed around that. And of course, with the weight of that ice, the branches broke. Well, for us, because we had coal fires those days, those branches were useful for firewood. And I could handle an axe with some considerable skill. And I used to use that axe, you see, and see Hitler every time I came down with it, you see. Fierce hate, real fierce hate. You see? But I doubt whether that finally was conducive to Hitler's suicide. I doubt very much. However, it was a terrible force for evil going out of me all the time. And that poor branch, of course, went into splinters easily. Then, after the war was over, very soon after the war was over, one day I had a dream. I was in a restaurant being served by waiters. One of those waiters was Hitler, just with his little moustache, and very, very affable, very charming, very, yes sir, what would you like sir, and this and that. It was Hitler talking English. And when I woke up, I thought, my goodness, is that the person against whom I vented all that hate? How perfectly ridiculous. You see? Perhaps it was a case of having a perspective from a profounder level upon that which took place at a level of confusion and absurdity. Now, that is just one example of that sort of thing. So you see, when this compassion awakes, then you get wise. In my case, that dream didn't particularly make me wise, apart from just giving a little insight into actual values. But after all, that also perhaps is a part of wisdom. And there was nothing but compassion for that man who brought so much horrible suffering to millions and millions of people and so forth. But he was fulfilling his particular place in the scheme of things. It's extraordinarily significant. In all the religions of the world, the devil is never destroyed. He is co-eternal, so to say. Eternal, of course, is too strong a word. But he exists. He is co-evil, E-V-A-L, co-evil, you see, with that which is the good. And he has his spell all the time. Why is this? We have our discriminative consciousness, good and bad, as we call it. But you see, the bad, the evil, is a stimulus. It is a challenge, which challenges the good to what? Not to fight the evil, not to fight me, the devil, but to change me, the devil, heal me of my devilry, and convert me into the perfect human, the true human. So when one sees evil, cosmic evil, for instance, is an expression of that sort of thing. And it comes first, the very first teacher who put that out very plainly and straightforwardly was Zarathustra. In his very first sermon after his enlightenment, he put that out. See, this evil is the stimulus, the challenge. And that challenge, if met in the right way, with the desire to understand and remain quiet inside, so that the harmony, ultimate harmony, will emerge. I can't bring about harmony by deliberate thinking. That can't be done. A musician can do that with his music. But then, you see, that is cultural procreation. This harmony which emerges is the fundamental harmony which lies at the heart of all things, and which is the real bliss at the heart of all things. The Buddha said, at the heart of all things lies eternal bliss. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? So that harmony emerges, and the work, the purpose of our existence is on the way to fulfillment. One of the great purposes of our existence is that we, through our purification, become instruments for the cosmic archetypal forces that function through the universe. The individual is the right apparatus for those forces to function. These archetypal forces are realities. All the religions have spoken of them by giving them various names. The names of the archangels, the angels, and so forth represent all this. And it's a wonderful study. The Kabbalah has gone very far in this, as well as the Puranas of the Hindus and so forth. They have gone very deeply into it all and given all these names to represent these forces. So one of the purposes of our existence is that we here on earth are instruments for the functioning of those forces. Now remember that those forces function both ways. Not in the sense of a struggle between good and evil, but construction and the dissolution of that which is constructed in order that a new construct may emerge which is more suitable for the more developed stage. Look at it that way, and then statements like Jesus is saying, resist not evil, will come to life. You will see what it means. You see, the harmony within oneself through quietness and stillness enables the transcendent to function freely without obstruction from me, because it is I who am doing the quarreling and the fighting, you see, and only perpetuating conflict instead of harmony. But if I allow that harmony to emerge from within myself by being quiet and so forth, then I can use my discriminative consciousness, as long as it remains a discriminative consciousness, in the constructive way, by letting the right thing happen. This is the great thing. Let the right thing happen. Just be quiet and observe, and you will become conscious gradually of the right thing. But the brain won't necessarily know it. Only if you are of the type which in India which we call the jnana yogi, you see, the yogi on the path of knowledge, of the perception which is able to go right into the heart of things, which is unerringly which has unerring insight, then even the brain will also know what you are really conscious of. And that becomes an immense power in you to heal your whole situation, yourself included, and your surroundings. This healing aspect is of prime importance. It is the whole making aspect. It is that which once again restores the unitary wholeness everywhere. In the Zarathustrian Gathas, for instance, Zarathustra teaches that the Supreme, of course, it's a monotheistic religion, so it talks in terms of the Supreme as God, Ahura Mazda, Lord of Life and Wisdom. The Supreme, if you live by the law of righteous living, by virtue, by pure virtue, the Supreme will grant you the gift of holiness, and of immortality. Now, how does immortality function? Everybody thinks of immortality as a continuity in living, in some form or other. So we invent all sorts of spiritual bodies which float about as independent entities. Now think carefully. The spiritual, the transcendent, is the infinite eternal. It is the one whole. You can't split up that one whole. You can't have my spirit, my Atma, or my mind in the supreme sense. Cannot be done. Just as we have for our instruction, we experience space. Now, can you in any way say this space which is enclosed within these four walls, you see, or four and a half walls, as the case may be. Can you split up any part of this space and say, this is my space, and somebody else say, no, all right, this is my space? You can't do it. So the spiritual, the transcendent, the eternal, the ultimate, and so forth, is a one whole. First, one sees it perhaps logically only, intellectually. One sees that, really. And when one sees that is really so, one ceases to think in terms of one's own fulfillment or fruition or anything like that. What we may call your fulfillment, one's own fulfillment, is the fulfillment of the totality in limited terms through your psychophysical organism. You see, if you can see things that way, all grasping for self must necessarily vanish, mustn't it? How can it remain when you realize that there is no separate me existing in some very subtle, invisible form? None at all. There is only the absolute, the totality. The whole of the infinite eternal is embodied in each and every single thing and each and every single person throughout the entire cosmos. First, wake up to that through just sort of seeing it by using your intellect. See that as a fact. And then you see this very strong selfness, I am I and nothing else. Take me as I am. When a person says, take me as I am, what does he mean? With all my faults and so-called virtues and so forth, the limited concrete thing which is a source of conflict, struggle, disharmony and so forth. Yes, of course, I will take that person as he or she is, exactly as he or she is. Because in taking that, in absorbing that in my own psyche, so to say, this purification process goes on in myself and in the other person at the same time. And thus, greater and greater harmony is released. And thereby, there comes the time when one touches the peak and one is truly human. I've suggested at our group meetings time and again the meaning of the word human, the blissful creator. We use the word mind, but do we know what we mean by that word? Can you present mind to me on a plate? Can you sort of show something concrete and say that this is mind? You can't. Like space, it is omnipresent, it is, you can't split it up, you can't break it up. Psyche is yours because this energy, mind is an archetypal form of the primordial creative energy. It's one archetypal form whose specific business is to act as a formative power where existence is concerned. And it is universal, it is cosmic. That mind functioning, coming in contact with corporeality, the brain, the nervous system, the ductless glands and so forth, gives rise to your particular type of thinking, feeling, your emotional reactions, your instinctive actions as we call them, and so forth. And that is psyche. That is yours specifically. All this functioning is psychical functioning. Modern existentialist psychologists have begun to see that nicely, especially men like Ken Wilber and others. And they are well on the way to really producing a harmonious vision of how the human being works. So now, this psyche has to undergo the purification. The Buddha said, purify the mind. That is the way of the Buddhas. Cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. That is, mind is too general and too vague a word. Purify the psyche. And mind, the universal thing, which is neither good nor bad in itself, it's power, energy, like electricity on the physical plane. It is power, you see, that functions freely through you. And its formative activity converts this, the psychophysical person, especially his psyche, into the true human. You look at a truly good man or woman, a holy man or woman. He or she is beautiful. It's extraordinary. I have watched this for many a year. See a person, the extraordinary beauty, without using set criteria of beauty present. Now, that way, there is the restoration of the consciousness of our unity. Not just an idea, a thought, not a blind faith, but a real faith because we are conscious of it. Therefore, all our psychical and physical activity expresses that faith, that knowledge, in our relationship with each other. So now, we come to the end of this summer school, but we are always at the beginning of our unity in eternity. It is always there. I wish you every happiness, every fulfillment. Grow in yourselves, awake, awake, awake to the transcendent. And in this awakening, you will be a benediction to yourselves and to the whole world. To the whole world, because we have no idea how our consciousness affects everything. This is the important thing. Grow. This awakening is an awakening of consciousness, not merely a sort of a change of concepts or a change of beliefs or ideas. They are more or less impotent, and in all cases they are binders. They are not releases. We are imprisoned in our beliefs and so forth. So live that way, and you will bring about fruition in the true sense, the great sense, wherever you are and however you may be placed. And I wish you joy of it. Bless you all.